5. What's attractive about looking at all philosophers in part suspiciously and in part mockingly is not that we find again and again how innocent they are, how often and how easily they make mistakes and get lost, in short, how childish and childlike they are, but that they are not honest enough in what they do, while, as a group, they make huge, virtuous noises as soon as the problem of truthfulness is touched on, even remotely. Collectively, they take up a position as if they had discovered and reached their real opinions through the self-development of a cool, pure, godlike, disinterested dialectic, in contrast to the mystics of all ranks, who are more honest than they are, and more stupid with their talk of inspiration. While basically, they defend, with reasons sought out after the fact, an assumed principle, an idea, an inspiration, for the most part some heartfelt wish which has been abstracted and sifted. They are all advocates who do not want to call themselves that. Indeed, for the most part, they are even mischievous pleaders for their judgments, which they baptize as truths, and very remote from the courage of conscience which would admit this, even this, to itself, very remote from that brave good taste which would concede as much, whether to warn an enemy or friend, or whether to mock themselves as an expression of their own high spirits. That equally stiff and well-behaved tartuffery, hypocrisy of old Kant, with which he enticed us onto the clandestine path of dialectic leading to, or more correctly, seducing us to his categorical imperative, this dramatic performance makes us discriminating people laugh, for it amuses us in no small way to keep a sharp eye on the fine tricks of the old moralists and preachers of morality. Or that sort of mathematical hocus-pocus with which Spinoza presented his philosophy, in the last analysis, the love of his own wisdom, to use the correct and proper word, as if it were armed in metal and masked, in order in this way to intimidate from the start the courage of any assailant who would dare to cast an eye on this invincible virgin and Pallas Athena. How much of his own shyness and vulnerability is betrayed by this masquerade of a sick hermit? 6. Gradually I came to learn what every great philosophy has been up to now, namely, the self-confession of its originator, and a form of unintentional and unrecorded memoir, and also that the moral, or immoral, intentions in every philosophy made up the essential living seed from which on every occasion the entire plant has grown. In fact, when we explain how the most remote metaphysical claims in a philosophy really arose, it's good and shrewd for us always to ask first, what moral is it, is he, aiming at? Consequently, I don't believe that a drive to knowledge is the father of philosophy, but that knowledge and misunderstanding have functioned only as a tool for another drive, here as elsewhere. But whoever explores the basic drives of human beings, in order to see how far they may have carried their game as inspiring geniuses, or demons and goblins, will find that all drives have already practiced philosophy at some time or another, and that every single one of them has all too gladly liked to present itself as the ultimate purpose of existence, and the legitimate master of all the other drives. For every drive seeks mastery, and, as such, tries to practice philosophy. Of course, with scholars, men of real scientific knowledge, things may be different, better, if you will, where there may really be something like a drive for knowledge, some small independent clock mechanism or other, which, when well wound, bravely goes on working, without all the other drives of the scholar playing any essential role. The essential interests of scholars thus commonly lie entirely elsewhere, in the family, or in earning a living, or in politics. Indeed, it is almost a matter of indifference whether his small machine is placed on this or on that point in science, and whether the promising young worker makes a good philologist, or expert in fungus, or chemist. Whether he becomes this or that does not define who he is. By contrast, with a philosopher, nothing is at all impersonal, and his morality in particular bears a decisive and crucial witness to who he is, that is, to the rank ordering in which the innermost drives of his nature are placed relative to each other. 7. How malicious philosophers can be. I know nothing more poisonous than the joke which Epicurus permitted himself against Plato and the Platonists. He called them Dionysiocolicies. The literal meaning of that, what stands in the foreground, is flatterers of Dionysus, hence accessories of tyrants and lickspittles. But the phrase says still more than that. They are all actors with nothing true about them. For Dionysiocolax was a popular description of an actor. And that last part is the real maliciousness which Epicurus hurled against Plato, the magnificent manners which Plato, along with his pupils, understood, the way they set themselves in the scene, things Epicurus did not understand that irritated him, the old schoolmaster from Samos, who sat hidden in his little garden in Athens and wrote 300 books, who knows, perhaps out of rage and ambition against Plato. It took 100 years until Greece came to realize who this garden god Epicurus was. Did they realize? 8. In every philosophy there is a point where the conviction of the philosopher steps onto the stage, or, to make the point in the language of an old mystery, the ass arrived beautiful and most valiant.